wrote or directed like five of my like top 10 funniest films ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great.
Yes.
He passed away in 2014. Born in 1945 and still just wonderful and sweet and super funny and beautiful, Goldie Hawn.
Goldie Hawn, that would make her 77?
Goldie Hawn's 77 years old today.
Wow, yeah. I still think of her as like the 19-year-old that was and on Laugh-In.
The girl in my soup or whatever. Yeah, right. Bjork is 57.
One of the stranger acts.
she's weird.
Come along.
And I will honestly say I've never been a big fan of her music, but people like her very much, and she's 57 years old today. Troy Aikman. I've never been a big fan of Troy Aikman either.
Neither have I.
But he's 56 today.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Griffey Jr., a very, you know, if Sam Musial is one of the all-time great outfielders of all time, Ken Griffey Jr. might be the best left fielder, well, top five at least, of them all.
Yeah.
In his prime, before he went to Cincinnati, man, Ken Griffey was.
Yeah, and he was
actually he was a center fielder.
He's hit one of the second most home runs out of anybody who hasn't done steroids. Third most.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. He had one of the most beautiful swings I've ever seen.
He did.
Oh man. Anyways, he's 53 years old today.
Mm-hmm.
And our final sports Hall of Famer of the day, born today in 1971, Michael Strahan, 51 years old. The all-time sacks leader still, I think, or single season sacks leader for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, famous for also being a TV host and having a really good gap in his teeth.
I'm going to throw one more name in there.
Okay.
Going back to 1907, Buck Rahm.
I don't know who Buck Rahm is.
Buck Rahm is. He was a songwriter, and they did BMI, the Union for Musical Artists. Did a tribute to their top five songwriters with airplay, radio airplay, in the first 50 years, which would have been probably in the 80s, maybe 1990 sometime. So everyone had done that.
Okay.
He was top five.
Really?
Along with Paul McCartney, Paul Simon, Jimmy Webb, and Kris Kristofferson.
Did Buck Rahm write Happy Birthday or something?
No, he wrote it, so much of it was doo-wop.
Okay.
He wrote the doo-wop songs, The Great Pretender, Twilight Time, The Magic Touch, Only You, all those all hits right. for the Platters, and also hits for Ike and Tina Turner, Duke Ellington, The Coasters, Drifters, Penguins, Ella Fitzgerald, Glenn Miller.
Okay, you know what's interesting about that, too? The Paul Simon song I was just talking about, Brene and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war, is a doo-wop song that pays as much tribute to the doo-wop people you just talked about as it does to Rene Magritte.
Buck Rahm.
There it is.
His name was Sam Rahm. But
Sam,
they called him Buck.
Sam the Buck Rahm. All right.
All right. Noon 3 and 5.
And I'll be back in just a minute with Justice Gordon Moore.
Yeah, we've got to usher him in, and we will see you back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. Rich Larson from the KYMN News Center. Jeff, getting out of here. I'll be back tomorrow morning. Coming up tomorrow on the KYMN Morning Show, we'll be talking with Andre Savadich, because coming up this Thanksgiving Day is the return of the Laura Baker Services Association Thanksgiving Dinner. And we'll have more on that tomorrow along with Tim McNiff. Stay tuned. Supreme Court Justice Gordon Moore is coming up next.
'Tis the season to experience Deck the Falls this Saturday in Cannon Falls. Get ready to start your Christmas shopping. Don't get caught unprepared. Winter will be here before you know it. So stop in to have your tires checked. Stop in at Nate's Garage and talk to their incredible team of mechanics that will get your car and tires ready for the crazy weather and road conditions to come. Stop by Chicago Ed's Fine Jewelry for some free, delicious cookies and hot cider for Deck the Falls. From fine-crafted watches and jewelry to dazzling diamonds, they will have sales on everything. Your family jeweler in downtown Cannon Falls since 1954. It's all happening during Deck the Falls in Cannon Falls this Saturday.
Family Fair, Northfield's convenient downtown grocer, is here with your Thanksgiving meat savings. Get your holiday essential frozen turkey, stovetop stuffing, and King's Hawaiian rolls. Family Fair is stocked with fresh seafood for holiday appetizers and fresh pies for dessert. Stop in, grab the weekly ad, get a Starbucks, get what you need, and be on your way in minutes. Family Fair, your local neighborhood market that provides real values for real people in real communities.
Tackle your hunger the right way at the Quarterback Club in Northfield. Their juicy chicken, tender baby back ribs, and flame-broiled burgers are all made to order. For daily specials, quality food, and great prices, make it the Quarterback Club in Northfield.
Do you want to spread the word about your business, event, or gathering? By all means, Graphics in downtown Northfield is here to help. We publish the Entertainment Guide, the Northfield Dundas Street Map, the Cannon Falls Discover Guide, and more. Make us your first stop and make the most of your advertising budget. Stop in at 17 Bridge Square in downtown Northfield between the Chamber and the Barbershop, or give us a call, 507-663-7937. By all means, Graphics, we're here to help.
9:05 on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. My name is Rich Larson, and welcome to our monthly chat with Justice Gordon Moore of the Minnesota State Supreme Court. Legal Talk. Good morning, Gordon. How are you?
Morning, Rich. How are you doing?
There we go. Sorry about that, Gordon. There, you didn't have your microphone on.
Okay, good morning, everyone.
Before we get going this morning, I want to publicly make a commitment to you, my friend Justice Moore. I don't know if you and I are going to have an opportunity to talk next month because of the holidays, or we'll work that out. But when we talk in January, by January, the third Monday in January, I will have a proper opening put together for this show. This is my promise to you, sir.
Good. That would be a fantastic Christmas gift, Rich. Kind of a, we need something kind of appropriately, I guess, legal sounding.
Exactly. Something serious, yet, not doom impending or anything
right,
like that.
Yes.
Exactly.
Right. Maybe some oye oye or gavel pounding or something like that.
Something like that, right? Do you remember the old... this is going way back on WCCO radio, the old Boone and Erickson show.
Absolutely.
And they had a legal segment every once a week or every couple of days. I don't remember, but they had a really good oh yay gavel pounding thing. Maybe we need to go dig that up.
You know what? There's a YouTube video that must have that. I mean,
and I'm sure I can find it too. So
I love the Boone and Erickson in the morning, and then the Cannon Mess in the afternoon.
Yeah,
drive time with Steve Cannon. That was old days.
That was my dad listened to WCCO just religiously. I remember all that stuff from being a kid. So this is the first time you and I have had a chance to talk since the election, and please allow me to offer my congratulations. You have been reelected to the Minnesota State Supreme Court, soundly defeating your opponent. It's my understanding, Gordon, that you are the top vote getter in the entire state of Minnesota. No one on that ballot got more votes than you did. Congratulations.
Thanks, Rich. First of all, just slight clarification there. That I was elected. I actually was appointed by the governor, and so this was my first actual time before the voters. But yeah, it was nice to see the outcome. When you're running uncontested, you start dreaming up scenarios for write-in campaigns, mm-hmm. and what happens if this happens. And, there were a lot of write-in votes there, which my wife keeps telling me to not think too much about, but I probably could have done a little bit more with regard to some statewide name recognition issues. But I joked with my colleagues that I think my vote tally was the product of being the first judge on the statewide ballot. I think people, including my own child, told me that she just got kind of tired filling in ovals on uncontested elections down the way. So I don't know how much the actual numbers mean, but I am humbled and honored beyond what I can really adequately say to be elected to that position. When I was appointed 2 years ago, I knew I'd be standing for election.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of assumed it would be contested. Mm-hmm. Many of our Supreme Court elections are. And so, you know, to say that was a little anxiety provoking would be an understatement when your livelihood is dependent on an election. But we got through it. And I think more importantly and more broadly, the system got through the election process so far with a lot less drama than 2020.
Which it's refreshing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's sort of how it's supposed to work. Mm-hmm. You know, people that lose elections concede the elections.
Yep.
They concede gracefully.
Yeah.
They're not filing endless lawsuits to, you know, try to undermine or attack, you know, the other side or the process or the people, more importantly, who are counting the votes, who are the real heroes, I think, of this election cycle, and particularly in some states where, you know, there is a lot of scrutiny, to say the least.
Well, it's still a mess in Arizona, but I think across the country, we've seen a lot more grace in this election than we had in years past. And frankly, especially here in Minnesota, I was frankly surprised to see so many concessions on election night. And it was good to see. It was really good to see.
Yeah, bipartisanly, too. I mean, you know, both sides. I mean, people just, you know, frankly behaved like you would hope and have always expected candidates for public office to behave.
Right.
You know, it's tough to lose. It's tough to lose a contested, hard-fought election. And to stand up and acknowledge that, and I think it was Congressman Ryan in Ohio that told people, and I would urge people to listen to his comments that night, that it was an honor and a privilege to concede the election after a hard-fought campaign, obviously one that had a lot of, you know, national attention. And he stood up there and didn't, you know, point fingers of blame. He just said, you know, the voters have spoken, time to move forward.
Right.
And, you know, I think everybody just kind of breathes a sigh of relief. It was a little bit like in 2000 when Al Gore stood before the cameras and said, you know what? This is going to stop now. I'm conceding. I could make arguments. I'm not going to do that for the good of the country, for the good of the people.
Right.
We have to move forward.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was, I think, a reassuring thing. But yeah, later in today's episode, I'd like to talk a little bit more about judicial elections, because this whole thing has been on my mind since we last talked about, you know, why judges are elected. And I thought we had a few more things to say about that. But yes, you know, the world goes on. The elections, the terms of judges actually start, you know, in January after the election. So it's 6-year terms for elected judges. So all the 105 members of the Minnesota judiciary who were on the ballot, and only one of whom, Charles Weber in Scott County, was contested. Everybody won those races, and so they will be sworn in again. You get re-sworn in every term.
Mm-hmm.
So I will take the oath of office from the Chief Justice again in January, as our constitutional officers will, and the members of the legislature. And so, the work continues, but it kind of begins anew with the start of the new term.
You've got, I would think maybe you get a little lift in your step, because you know you've got 6 years now ahead of you to do the good work, continue the good work that you've done.
Well, I wouldn't be candid if I told you that the prospect of a contested election is a huge distraction.
Sure.
And talking to my colleagues that have gone through that, even primary elections, the work doesn't stop. I mean, the citizens expect the judges and the justices of the state to get their work done, get the opinions out, and that's hard enough. But to be attending fundraisers and parades and things like that, while it's invigorating and engaging, and some might argue good, it's a drain on time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, will stand for election again in 2028.
Yes.
Should you decide to.
Yes, yeah. I would be eligible if, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be still Compass Menace and continuing to perform effectively. Yes, I would be, I guess, 65 at that point.
Okay.
So, yeah, that would be another opportunity. You don't have to. I mean, obviously, I couldn't serve another full 6-year term beyond that, because in Minnesota, judges have to retire the last day of the month that they turn 70.
I didn't know that.
Yes, which for me would be April of 2023. And so that's why most...
April of, not 2023.
2033. Yes. Yeah. I'm advancing things a little bit. 33. Thank you. And, you know, most judges do get appointed initially to their terms because they're basically filling the rest of a retired judge's justice's term. So, I'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Right.
Down the way.
Right. Well, you've got plenty of time to think about that.
Yeah. And my goal coming to the court was to establish that I could do the work and that I could do it credibly. I mean, going from a district court job to an appellate court job is a big jump. Mm-hmm. It's a big leap. There's just no doubt about that. I mean, my colleagues who had served on the Court of Appeals had probably a little bit more training than I did coming from a district court position to work in an appellate environment. But I have been, you know, working hard every day to try to earn my credibility in that regard, and it's really honoring and frankly really humbling to actually see the results and realize that, you know, the job that I've actually held for the last 2 years is now a job that I've been elected to by the people, not just appointed to by a politician.
Well, you've clearly earned the trust of the people, and I personally am very glad to see it, because I think you're a boon to the state.
So. I just want to extend my thanks to the people that have reached out and told me that they supported me. They didn't have to do that. This is an uncontested election. You know, they didn't have to say boo, but I've had so many positive comments from around the community and in St. Paul and through the judicial and legal community, people just being decent and supportive. And, and to everybody who supported me, thank you. If you didn't support me because you either didn't know who I was or had a concern about something, I guess I hope to earn your support in a later election and, you know, move forward.
Right. Well, again, congratulations. So beyond the election, what's been going on with the Supreme Court this month?
Well, we're coming up on our December calendar. Our December calendar starts actually in November. It starts a week from today on the 28th. We have 12 cases for argument for consideration in December. Not all of them have oral argument with them. We're kind of back to the first-degree murder theme that we had in September. We have 5 first-degree murder cases. 4 of them are direct appeals. A reminder to the listeners that in Minnesota, first-degree murder is the most serious form of homicide or murder, generally involving premeditated murders, some murders committed in the scope of during commission of other felonies. Those go straight to the Supreme Court. They don't go to the Court of Appeals. So we hear those directly. Mm-hmm. So we have 4 direct appeals from first-degree murder convictions and then 1 post-conviction relief case. Those also, when they involve first-degree murders, go directly to our court. Post-conviction relief is a way for a person to attack a conviction after it's occurred by arguing that legal, it's different than an appeal. It's a process for, you know, sometimes bringing forth new evidence or new witnesses or making an argument that the law has changed or something like that.
Is that then asking for a new trial, or is that just asking to have the verdict overturned?
It's most commonly the former, a new trial, but sometimes it's the latter. If there just is an argument that the conviction was, you know, violated the law for some reason, the state doesn't get a do-over if a person is acquitted at a criminal trial. Mm-hmm. Or if a conviction is vacated because of the insufficiency of evidence by an appellate court, the state doesn't get to retry that person. Mm-hmm. Unless the reason the conviction was overturned was because of a legal error, such as a jury instruction mistake or something like that, in that case, then if it's not related to the sufficiency of the evidence, the person would get a new trial. We have 2 tax court appeals, 1 workers' compensation court of appeals. Those are executive branch courts that go directly to us. And then 4 cases from the Court of Appeals on petitions for review. Last month, Rich, we talked a little bit about the Polymet permit, water discharge permit issue. That case actually got moved to December because of an issue with one of the lawyers. And so that is being heard a week from this Wednesday. That's the question of the contested case hearing related to the issuance of permits for the copper nickel mine in northern Minnesota. And that's a big one. That has a record, I think. One of the justices said 340,000 pages of materials that were generated during the permitting process. Now, obviously, that's not the direct record, but the direct record itself is like, I mean, the briefs, the Friends of the Corp briefs, I mean, like 1,500 pages or something like
that. You guys are, I mean, that's a lot of work to go through for one case, and it's a really important case,
it's
too.
It's a huge case. We have two law clerks that have worked on the bench memo. It's an enormous case.
Right.
It has a lot of implications, and it's we were all warned to get started early on the reading for this case because, you know, you can normally read another, you know, another justice's case in, you know, half a day or something like that, but this Polymat case is not going to be that.
I mean, this is going to be tough.
So, yeah, Thanksgiving for me is going to be a combination of family, turkey, maybe a little soccer, football, and a lot of reading.
A lot of bench memos.
Yeah, exactly. We do have an exoneration compensation case that's kind of interesting. Back, Dana Rochelle Back versus State. The legislature passed a law a few years ago that allows people who were exonerated because of a wrongful conviction.
Mm-hmm.
Many people have probably heard about the Innocence Project, people being exonerated who were, you know, sitting in prison because of a, you know, DNA sample that ended up being tested and revealing they weren't the person who committed it.
Right.
Question is, what type of relief, financial relief, should occur for people that have had to spend prison time that they, you know, arguably should never have spent?
Interesting.
And so exoneration compensation is the statute that was passed, and that has been back and forth before the court and the legislature. Ms. Back was convicted as second-degree manslaughter for the alleged involvement of a murder of a former boyfriend. And her case was thrown out by the state Supreme Court in 2009. Was vacated because of the lack of evidence. And so she filed a claim for exoneration compensation, mm-hmm. which has gone back and forth. This is the second trip to the state Supreme Court. In 2017, the state Supreme Court ruled part of the statute unconstitutional. The legislature fixed it. The petition was resubmitted, and we're considering that. And Back's case is actually being heard on Wednesday the 30th, involving right before the Polymat case. So if you were to tune in to a session, that would be interesting for sure. In December, it would be Wednesday the 30th.
My gosh. Now, so are you being asked to decide if the state should be compensating her at all, or are you being asked to decide how much she should be compensated?
It's really the former. The amount of compensation is listed by the legislation. I believe it's $50,000 for each year in prison, $20,000 for each year on supervised release. The question, though, that in Back's case is, you know, was she exonerated under the meaning of the law?
Interesting. Okay.
And, you know, without getting more into the details of it, it's an interesting statutory interpretation question, and, you know, it's got a lot of implications for other cases.
Yeah. Well, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, those are two of the highlights on our December calendar. We are, you know, moving forward on other issues, too. We're dealing with the ABA, the American Bar Association, mm-hmm. has provided the court with some recommendations for the relationship between the court and the Office of Lawyers for Professional Responsibility in response to some concerns that have been raised regarding that issue. You know, that's the office that disciplines attorneys. And so we are considering those recommendations, and there's going to be at some point a very large public hearing on that after the first of the year. So that's something we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
The question of the bar exam and how the bar exam does it or doesn't it really provide a path to being a lawyer that is, you know, that is relevant in a modern sense. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of critics of the bar exam. Is that a fair way to is that a fair hurdle to require people to jump through before they provide legal services?
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at there's three subcommittees that have been appointed by the state Board of Law Examiners that are looking at alternative models or paths to legal work in the state of Minnesota. So that's a stay tuned for 2023 discussion, too.
That actually raises a couple interesting questions in my mind. First of all, once a person passes the bar exam, are they required to take it again ever?
No.
Okay.
Nope. Once you pass, and within that stage, you're not, unless you are disciplined and are suspended or, you know, frankly, removed from the bar, then under those circumstances you would. But some states require you to take their individual bar exams. Mm-hmm. Others, you know, the uniform bar exam states, which is a consortium of states that basically give the same type mm-hmm. of exam, you can waive into other states if you get a certain UBE score.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a path that some lawyers use to get licensed in Minnesota, okay. depending on what our cut score is.
Is there any... I mean, because, you know, the law is a living thing, and it evolves and it changes over time. Is there any continuing education or updated education that lawyers are required to undergo?
Yes, absolutely. We're required to have 45 hours each reporting cycle, which I believe is 3 years. So I think it's 15 hours of what we call continuing legal education a year. For judges, it's continuing judicial education.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first week of December, the judges will be convening at the annual conference of judges. You know, that's a way for judges to hear updates on case law and other things from experts, policy experts, legal experts. And it's really important for us to maintain education.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a static thing.
Right.
I mean, the law changes dramatically, as we've seen Supreme Court decisions can change dramatically, and so we have to adapt to that.
Yeah, I would think that's really important. I'd never thought about that before, but I'm glad to know that you guys have to update yourselves.
A couple of other things of interest to me and hopefully to the listeners. Over the last week, there was a bombshell story that dropped in the New York Times about another alleged leak from the United States Supreme Court.
Yes.
And this alleged, I want to capitalize that and underline it because mm-hmm. it's been denied. But as listeners may be aware, the New York Times reported that one of the justices, Samuel Alito, allegedly told private dinner companions about how the high court was going to decide a landmark case of in 2014, Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. And for people that are in the legal community, you know that the Supreme Court decided that requiring a company to provide contraception mm-hmm. as part of health coverage violated religious freedom mm-hmm. of the company. That mm-hmm. was Hobby Lobby. And so this story was brought to the New York Times by this kind of controversial figure,
okay.
a very conservative member of a religious community that had been, frankly, very much to the right on the reproductive rights issue, and now has kind of gone the other direction.
Interesting.
And there's emails that were obtained. The story was sourced, and it's, to say the least, highly problematic.
Wow.
Very problematic. Justice Alito has denied discussing the authorship of the Hobby Lobby case, he's basically denied the story. So
sure.
I want to emphasize that. But in light of what happened with the Dobbs decision
right.
that Justice Alito authored and the leak of that draft opinion, which has not yet been the result of the internal investigation hasn't been revealed to the people. You know, this is raising a lot of concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
along the lines of this, Justice Kagan, Justice Alito have engaged in kind of this back and forth over the summer over, you know, the question of the court's legitimacy, frankly.
Wow.
I mean, there's been a back and forth through different speeches, and, you know, there's a lot of concern right now about this whole topic. And I'm not going to say more about it other than I know initially, you know, the comments in the media were to blame staff members or law clerks for this this Dobbs decision being disseminated. And the silence on that front, to me, has been noteworthy. I would think if there had been somebody that was implicated in doing that we would have found out about that. So stay tuned on this. The New York Times, I don't think, is going to let this go. And the Chief Justice, in my opinion, is in a really difficult position here. I mean,
really?
I think with regard to the institutional legitimacy of the court, which he is the protector of, and I know from his public comments he's quite concerned about, as he mm-hmm. should be, about mm-hmm. the legitimacy of the court, the perception of the court in the American public, and, you know, just how the people view the court. Is it viewed as a political partisan organization, or is it viewed as an unbiased arbiter of important legal disputes?
Leaks, in my memory, leaks from the Supreme Court have been unheard of until now. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on this at all, but I will just say it's interesting that they're both connected to Justice Alito.
You know, I'm not going to say anything more about this, Rich, yep. other than to just say that I think concerned citizens should be paying close attention yeah. to the follow-up on these stories, because
we have a responsibility to pay attention to this.
Yeah, we do. I mean, the court, because of the legislature at the federal level, Congress's inability to legislate in certain important areas because of bipartisan divides, the court has been delegated, in a sense, or has become the decider on some of these incredibly important public policy issues.
A lot of public policy issues.
And the question is, you know, is that good? Is that appropriate?
Right.
Well, that's another discussion.
It
you
is.
Know, political science, you know, maybe that's the 301 class. But I just am concerned that if citizens view the court as just being a political beast, I mean,
yeah.
just as an arm of political parties, and whoever can ram through appointments to the court will control that agenda. You know, that to me does some serious damage to the institution.
And unfortunately, with our partisan situation right now, that is sort of the way. And it's not just in the last 5 years. I mean, we're talking the last 30 some years. I mean, that's the way the public perception has been drifting too.
Right.
You're right. I agree with you. It's a sad thing.
It's, you know, I we've talked about this before. At the state level, we are very, very careful to mm-hmm. not engage in discussions regarding our cases outside of the office. Clerks are instructed that we protect our materials. We honor the requirement that we confine our discussions about cases to those who have a reason to know within the court, and that draft opinions that are being circulated aren't leaked. They're not discussed.
Right.
Things can change. And, you know, what ends up coming out is the product of considerable internal discussions and edits, and not outside influences.
Right. Right. So let's talk a little bit about judicial elections
bit. Yeah. Just to kind of a little primer here on judicial elections. I mean, people have asked me over the last month or so, why do we elect judges in this state?
Right.
Why? You know, the underpinning of the question is this really worth it? What are we doing if there's only one contested election? It's been part of our system actually since statehood. It's been part of the Minnesota Constitution since 1858. Actually, I learned the judges started at 7-year terms, and then that moved to 6. Prior to the late 1800s, however, the balloting process was controlled by the political party. It wasn't until the late 1800s that the so-called Australian or the secret ballot was required to be used in Minnesota, requiring ballots to be printed on plain white paper at the direction of public officials, not political parties. All party names are on it, and voters could mark their choices in secret. Seems like a logical, obvious thing,
yeah.
but that isn't
yeah.
always been.
Interesting.
But most importantly, in 1912, the Minnesota legislature mandated that all judicial elections were to be nonpartisan. So party designations removed from ballots,
mm-hmm.
candidates would not be required or permitted to find or to get party affiliation. And so that's essentially how it has been since then. The incumbent designation was added to the ballot in the late 40s. The legislature rejected a retention election, which is basically after you're appointed by a governor, there'd be the voters would be given the question of whether you should be retained in the election, not whether you should be elected over somebody else. That so-called Missouri plan has never been adopted here.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 1949, the legislature decided that judges would get the benefit of having the incumbent designation, and that we are the only office that has that on the ballot. And the reason for that is because incumbency does mean something,
yes.
and it's a belief that the citizens are better better educated in knowing who's actually held the job. And that's been really important since the creation of the 49-member Judicial Selection Commission in 1990, which was a reaction mm-hmm. to some 1980s appointments that were viewed as too political.
Mm-hmm.
And so the commission fields applications for open judgeships and makes 3 to 5 recommendations to the governor, considering each applicant's integrity, maturity, health of job-related temperament, diligence, legal knowledge, ability, and experience in community service. And so for each vacancy, 13 members of the commission, comprised of 9 at-large members and then 4 local members from the district where the vacancy occurred. They do due diligence. They evaluate the candidates and they make recommendations to the governors after an interview process.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of screening that goes on. members are required. I get calls all the time from members of the Judicial Selection Commission. Hey, have you heard of this lawyer? What do you know about this lawyer? And, you know, sometimes I do have information and often at times I don't if they didn't come from Southwest Minnesota where I worked for all these years. But the governor has sole constitutional authority to make judicial appointments. But because of the strength of the Judicial Selection Commission that was created as a bipartisan response to concerns about politics, governors have very rarely declined to select their appointments from the commission's recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, since the early 1990s, there have been very few judges who weren't on that list of recommended candidates. And
right.
so I bring this up because I think it really is part of the reason why we haven't had the partisan reentry into judicial politics in Minnesota. You know, the number of contested elections has dropped with the limitation of party influence on judicial elections. And I don't think there's any doubt about that correlation.
Right.
The more partisan the elections are, the more contested and the more money, the PAC money are going to be. And I'm not suggesting that there shouldn't be contested elections. I mean, you know, that it can, we can have a robust discussion about issues, but the notion of political parties selecting candidates for judges, and then, you know, we all saw the onslaught of commercials funded by outside interest groups. I mean, that's the kind of thing that I think is really corrosive to the judicial branch.
When you were a district judge, were you ever challenged for your position?
No. Nope. I was up for election in 2014 and was not challenged in the judicial elections. For instance, Northfielders would have seen on their ballot the third judicial district court judge candidates.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the Southeast Minnesota quadrant from Rice down to Houston County and over to like Albert Lee and up to Owatonna, that area. And so those judges that were on the ballot, you know, and you were asked to vote for people undoubtedly that you've never been in front of. I mean, why would you know somebody from Winona or, you know, Lanesboro?
Right.
I mean, it's just the way things go. But again, having that incumbent designation should give people a sense that, look, this is somebody that's gone through this process. I mean, the people that are on the district court bench now have gone through this judicial selection process and have had their candidacy vetted by people whose job it is to ask tough questions. And trust me, they ask really tough questions.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
It's a very intimidating election process. They are concerned about making sure that the right people get on the bench and, frankly, that the wrong people don't get on the bench.
Right. That's the important. I mean, they're equal sides of the thing, but it is very important that we don't put the wrong people
on the bench. Right. Now, I don't want to sound like, you know, people are clones. I mean, you know, people come to the judiciary through different life experiences.
Right.
They have different backgrounds, temper, you know, there's public defenders, prosecutors, corporate lawyers, in-house lawyers, litigators, you know, judges from other jurisdictions. But they share a passion for public service and an interest in doing the job. And that's what we need.
Right.
But the system is enhanced by viewpoint diversity, geographic diversity, racial, ethnic, socioeconomic diversity. I mean, that bringing those perspectives to the bench is important as well.
Right. Now, there are states in the country where judges do hold a party designation.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I told this story, I think, to some. We were in North Carolina visiting my oldest son in August and visited the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the former Chief Justice, Sherry Beasley, who just ran for the Senate unsuccessfully, she was defeated by one of her colleagues for Chief Justice by 400 votes in the 2020 election.
Wow.
I mean, one colleague running against each other with pure political labels, Beasley being the Democrat and the now Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court as a Republican. And, you know, I asked this guy that was giving us the tour, I said, well, how did that work internally? And he just kind of looked at me and shook his head. I mean, that just cannot be conducive to collaborative. That just ends up siloing people, you know, and that's what you don't want.
There's a reason we call it a collegial court.
I mean,
you guys are expected to treat each other with great respect and There's got to be some dignity involved,
right,
in that, too.
And just to finish the story, there's no indication that the justices in North Carolina, you know, didn't do those things, but it did create, you know, an impression of a completely partisan process.
Of course it did.
And, you know, that's just, you shouldn't have to be raising money immediately upon getting appointed to a judicial position. I mean, when we go down that road, I think we are in danger of having our court system just become captured by special interests.
We talked about this a little bit last week, too, and I will say again, the idea of a judicial candidate or a sitting judge going out to raise money makes my stomach hurt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I became an uncontested candidate for mm-hmm. this last term, I decided it would be unethical and inappropriate for me to be asking anybody for money for an uncontested race. I mean, judges can't ask directly anyway.
Right.
Their campaigns make the ask, but I just shut down. I just told the people that were working with me, you know, anything I'm going to do is going to be self-funded and, you know, we're going to see how it goes.
Yeah.
But so that's the little judicial election information I wanted to give out. And you know, we carry on, and hopefully what we're doing in Minnesota is viewed as being effective in supporting the people and supporting the needs of the state. And I hope it continues this way in a nonpartisan fashion, because we have seen in other states when it's not that way, it can become pretty ugly and people get pretty cynical about it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I just from a personal standpoint, I'm very happy to see you reelected, first because I think that you belong on the bench up in St. Paul, but secondly, it also means that Legal Talk has now been renewed for another 6 years. So
yes, the primary concern.
Exactly. Well, you know, we got programming we have to fill. So.
Right, and now we have a renewed emphasis on getting that bumper music, too.
Exactly right, exactly right. So, Justice Gordon Moore, is there anything else you would like to address?
I don't think so, Rick. Happy holidays to everybody that's listening.
Indeed.
I appreciate the people who do listen to our show. I do get some follow-up comments, and I really appreciate the support of Northfielders and others in the area that find us, you know, online, and wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving and a sane and safe holiday season.
And the same to you, sir. You've been listening to Legal Talk with Justice Gordon Moore on AM 1080 and FM 95.1 KYMN Radio. And coming up in just a minute, we'll hear a little Boz Skaggs. Thanks for listening, folks.
Real Radio, True Variety, 95.1, The One.